This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You are unknowingly revealing a trail of information about yourself as you go about your day. The microchips in our cell phones, cable TV boxes, and supermarket scanners record thousands of details about our lives, who we call, what we buy, where we travel, how late we order a drink in a bar, or how early we get coffee at a diner. Our guest Stephen Baker says mathematicians and computer scientists are getting better at sorting through those jillions of little facts to reveal things about us, our tastes, phobias, healthcare issues, political views, even our love interests. Baker calls these Jedi Knights of data analysis the numerati. That's the title of his new book about the people and corporations using advanced math and powerful computers to learn about our lives and make money from what they learn. Stephen Baker has written for Business Week for more than 20 years and is co-author of its blog, blogspotting.net. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Stephen Baker, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book.
Thank you, Dave.
Your book is called The Numerati. It's about all these mathematicians and computer scientists who are going to be managing, accumulating, and analyzing data that tells them things about us. Well, let's talk about some of the ways that these computer whizzes, the numerati as you call them, might work with data in the future. And one of them involves us as shoppers. Now, everybody knows about loyalty cards. We get the little card from our local supermarket or sporting goods store or department store. And whenever we use that, that generates data through the cash register on everything we buy week after week. They get our shopping list. But you note that the supermarkets, for example, haven't really done much with that data until now. What are some of the ways that computer technicians see for retailers to use all of this information they get?
Well, right now, if you walk into a grocery store, they don't know who you are until you check out. And so they can't take advantage of everything that they know about you and haven't bothered to do that yet. But what they want to do is have you identified as you enter the store, either with a shopping card or a loyalty card that has a radio signal on it, and then they'll know who you are, and they'll look at the patterns of your shopping and other people that they think shop like you, and they'll make suggestions, almost the way Amazon or Netflix make suggestions about which movies you might like to watch or what books you might want to read, and they'll try to put us in different tribes or buckets of people according to our preferences. So me, for example, I'm a guy who I'm kind of a cheapskate, and if a recipe calls for red bell peppers, I tend to buy the green ones sometimes because the red ones cost twice as much. So they might say, we've got a group of people that consistently buy green bell peppers instead of red. Now, what else do those people, those cheapskates, buy? And they could profile me as a cheapskate and suggest all kinds of things to me. And it can get incredibly complex.
Now, let's make sure I understand how this physically would work. You or I walk into a grocery store, and we pick up a cart, and there's a computer chip in the cart, and we scan our loyalty card in the cart, or there's a radio signal on the card we carry in our wallet?
Well, Microsoft is rolling out one of these systems, and then there are European companies that are also doing it. And what they want to do is have a little computer terminal on the cart, and you swipe your loyalty card, and it immediately knows who you are and then suggests a shopping list for you. And some people might find this very intrusive.
Yeah,
people may choose not to have it.
Yeah, I can imagine people jumping with fright when they see their shopping list pop up. But let's explore this a moment. So then once you've in effect checked in at the supermarket and they have your entire shopping history there on a big database, they then will offer you specials and coupons that are uniquely tailored to your interests and buying habits?
They're not only tailored to us and what we want to buy, but they're also tailored to what the store wants to sell. They can make all kinds of calculations about how much money they can get out of us and how quickly they can get rid of their surplus. I mean, if a store has a bunch of fish that's going to go rotten, then they can do calculations on how many shoppers are going to they need to send the promotion to, and which type of shoppers, and they want to maximize the amount of money we're spending at the supermarket.
And so some kinds of people will respond to that, and some won't. Now you point out that there are some kinds of shoppers that retailers call barnacles. Who are they?
Right. Barnacles are cheapskates. Barnacles are people who go from one store to the next, always looking for the bargains and not really buying anything else. And the retailers detest barnacles. And now they have the means to explore the patterns of the barnacles and single them out. And once they know who the barnacles are, increasingly they're going to do things to discourage barnacles from even coming into their store. They're going to try to fire the barnacles. They might do this by giving them coupons or advertisements for things that the barnacles would never want or things that are incredibly expensive.
So as for someone who shows a propensity to spend some discretionary income, we'll get a bunch of enticing specials. But if I'm a barnacle, I'm going to get a bunch of stuff that doesn't interest me at all, and I'm going to get bored and leave.
Right.
Now, you point out that there are people who, for example, if there are people who shop on a budget and they will spend so much every week, there are certain kinds of bargains you might not want to offer them. Is that right? If you're a retailer?
Yeah. If you spend $150 a week, then the supermarket doesn't want to sell you anything at a discount, because that means that a higher percentage of what you're spending is discounted and their margins are lower. So they would try to get rid of things on discount to shoppers who aren't on a budget. And they can easily figure out which shoppers are on budgets, because the people regularly spend about the same amount of money.
So if retailers don't want bargain hunters, cheapskates, and would be inclined not to offer them incentives to come back, like discounts, I mean, isn't that kind of discriminatory? I mean, it's often low-income people who are bargain hunters who really need to save money, and this would allow retailers to, in fact, deny savings to the people who most need them.
It is discriminatory, and I think you're going to find, as the numerati expand and develop their power, that in industry after industry, what this knowledge does is it gives them the power to discriminate. We've had the luxury of being treated in groups for millennia, and we benefit from that in lots of ways. Like in insurance, those of us who are healthy subsidize those of us who are less healthy. And because we're ignorant about it, and because the companies are relatively ignorant about it, we can all be satisfied. But as we and they learn more details, then they're going to be able to discriminate against us, and we're going to be able to demand special treatment based on what we know about ourselves. And this kind of breaks the social contract that we've had through the ages.
And to go back to this idea of associations, they might, if they discover that I'm the kind of shopper who might like an expensive or exotic treat, that might mean that I might, when I enter the store, my electronic coupon might pop up for some exotic dessert that my neighbor might not get a coupon for, right?
That's right. I mean, traditionally, retailers have looked at us in the broadest terms. They haven't had the data on individuals, so that they've had to look at us as whites and blacks, or rich and poor, or, you know, the big demographic groups in our society. And they've had to assume that we act more or less like other people in our religion, our race, our zip code. Now they can zero in on us so that they can give your next door neighbor, who in many ways resembles you by the old measurements, a totally different pitch than they give you. And that person might be in a different tribe.
Tribes, people with common habits and tastes and cultural patterns?
Right. But sometimes they're common tastes and cultural patterns that we don't recognize ourselves.
Can you give us an example?
Well, in politics, I talked to a company called Spotlight, and they are trying to put us into different political tribes. And these aren't tribes of Republicans or Democrats and Independents, and they're not soccer moms, and they're not terror-frightened widows, or all the different groups that we've known about in the past. They're trying to figure out what our deepest values are, what our feelings are about things like freedom, community, the outdoors, and they're placing us in these various tribes by going through gazillions and gazillions and gazillions of our personal data. They're going through what we've bought in the past, where we live, how many cats we have in our household, what kind of car we drive, all those things, and they're putting us into these tribes.
That's one area where, you know, for years politicians have been dealing with data on basic demographic variables to predict ideological and voting patterns. And we all know what they are: their gender, their race, their income, their education, their union affiliation, religious affiliation, and so on. Can you really, if you incorporate these hundreds of millions of pieces of seemingly irrelevant data, like whether I go fishing or how many cats I have, do you really get a picture that tells you something that's more – that offers more political insight?
It can. We should make clear that those standard groupings, the hunters, the churchgoers that we're very familiar with, are still extremely useful to the political consultants. And they can get, you know, McCain and Obama, they can get the 45% each of the population through appealing to them the old-fashioned ways. But what they're trying to figure out is where among those – where hidden in a Republican district is a potential Democrat we can turn in Cuyahoga County, Ohio. They're trying to cherry-pick people with this micro-targeting. So it's not for the vast majority of it. It's for special little tribes that they're hoping to nab and then hit them with very, very targeted advertisements. Now the trend is more towards – understanding us more deeply as people and saying this person might be a Democrat, might be a Republican, could go either way. But if we understand this person as a person, we can hone the advertisement and the targeted telephone call or the internet advertisement perfectly for him or her.
So in this election, we're going to see, in effect, individually targeted appeals on what? The internet, phone calls, door hangers?
It's going to be all three of those: internet, phone calls, and people knocking on doors. Okay. And mailings. Mailings are a really easy way to single out people.
If these techniques allow you to find a member of a tribe and find a Democrat in a community full of Republicans and then target ads. I mean, it sounds like an awful lot of effort to identify a voter or a few voters. Is it cost effective? Do you know what they spend doing that?
Well, how much do you think Gore would have spent for 300 Florida voters in the year 2000? The price of a voter is, it's really hard to calculate, because if you win 40% of the vote or 60% of the vote, every additional voter that you get is meaningless. But if you're right at 50, the value goes up dramatically. And it's in the races where they're going to be between 49.5 and 50.5, where they're going to spend a lot of money to get a relative handful of voters. It might be 50, might be 100, but they'll spend quite a bit for those voters.
Well, national security is one area where people have been mining data for a long time. And apparently illegally in some cases, it seems. And I was fascinated by a description you had of a man named Jeff Jonas who had been involved in this and then had come upon a completely different view about the privacy threats to this kind of activity. Tell us about him.
Jeff Jonas is a very unusual guy. He dropped out of high school and started up a software company, and at one point had 20 employees, and a year later he was sleeping in his car, and then he got a broken neck when he was on a test drive to buy a BMW and was paralyzed, and now he does Ironman triathlons. But anyway, he lives in Las Vegas, and he was hired by the casinos to develop a software that would track the data of all kinds of people so that they could try to find the bad guys, the people that were coming in, the criminals or people that were coming in to try to rip off the casinos. And he built a system to do that, and it looks for similar names, similar phone numbers, and goes through massive amounts of data. And the CIA invested in his company. And later, after 9/11, it became very clear that he was onto something that was going to be very useful for national security. So Jeff Jonas, who describes himself as a former beach bum, is now a leading figure in the war on terror. But he really, really objects to statistical data mining, which is really the heart of what the Numerati is all about. So of all the Numerati, he's the dissenting vote.
What use did the CIA make of his techniques? What were they doing in pursuit of terrorists?
Well, they want to get a handle on everybody in the country and everybody in areas that they're studying, and they want to figure out which people are the same people, because they get confused. People have aliases and false names and all kinds of ways of hiding themselves, and so it's a way of sorting out people. That's really what they wanted to do. It's a very basic tool, but it remains a very necessary one in the war against terrorism.
And this came to trouble Jeff Jonas.
Well, what he was seeing and what he sees today is an increasing reliance on statistical data mining. And so what he looks at is, okay, we know this person is associated with some act of terror, you know, the bombing of the USS Cole, for example. We know that. So who does this person know? Well, he knows this person, he calls that person and that person. And so that type of detective work is kind of like old-fashioned sleuthing. You start with a lead and you follow it and you follow all the connections it has. And he's fine with that. What he doesn't like is the idea, okay, how does everybody behave? And are there patterns of their behavior that might indicate that they might be a terrorist? And he thinks that we don't know enough about terrorists to come to those sorts of conclusions, and that the consequences of getting it wrong are much too high. You know, there was this one story that I had that I didn't put in the book because I couldn't confirm it, but I heard that there was an FBI agent on the West Coast who wanted to keep an eye on the hummus consumption around San Francisco. And his idea was that a sharp spike in hummus consumption could tip investigators to the presence of terrorism. Now, that is inane. But there's nothing to protect us in statistical data mining from really, really silly analysis like that. And what's scary about it is, you can have silly analysis, but then you go and find all the numbers and you put it all together and you come up with a conclusion and it's wrapped up as science and math, and yet it's based on stupidity. And that's a real concern for Jonas.
You know, your book is about a world in which data is generated in such gargantuan quantities and shared so widely. And I'm one of those, and many of us are from time to time, where we just want to retreat from all that. I recently had someone walk into a bank branch with my bank account number and a fake ID trying to withdraw money. And I had to close the account and reopen a new one. And then later, when I had to fill out a form to co-sign my college-age daughter's lease, they wanted my bank account number. And I said, you know, I'm not so sure I want to share that number anymore. There are times that I think we just feel like we want to stop using our credit cards, pay with cash, and retreat from all this digital stuff. And you write at the end of this book, you say, these statistical tools are going to be quietly assuming more and more power in our lives. We might as well learn how to grab the controls and use them for our own interests. How does one do that? How does one embrace the world of the Numerati?
Well, I think that there are great opportunities for entrepreneurs, and they're already looking at them, for them to develop tools so that we can monitor our own data and get a sense of who's using it and to what end, so that we can protect it and give it to people that we want, that we trust with it. And we're going to develop relationships with certain companies that we trust with the data and be able to shut it off to other people. And eventually, we could sell our data. I mean, that's essentially what we're doing when we go into a supermarket and give them our customer loyalty card. We're selling our data. We're exchanging it for refund, for discounts. And we'll be able to sell our data. There could be markets that open up for data where we decide, how much of it we want to sell, and at what price.
Well, Stephen Baker, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Stephen Baker is the author of the new book, The Numerati. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you've seen Juno, Superbad, or Arrested Development, then chances are you've been won over by Michael Cera's low-key but very funny performances. In Juno, Cera played Paulie Bleeker, the well-meaning teenager who had sex once with his good friend Juno, and it left her pregnant. In Superbad, Cera played Evan, a graduating senior, trying to buy some beer, stay away from the cops, and get to a party. And in the critically acclaimed but ratings-challenged TV series Arrested Development, he played the often awkward George Michael Bluth, perhaps the only sane member of the absurd Bluth family. In the new film Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, Cera plays Nick, a New Jersey teenager who's nursing a broken heart after his pretty but shallow and self-centered girlfriend breaks up with him on his birthday. Nick plays bass in an indie rock band and is convinced by his bandmates that he should play a gig with them in Manhattan and then go with them to a concert of their favorite band, even though he doesn't feel ready to leave the house yet. At the gig, he meets Nora, a smart music lover who goes to school with his ex-girlfriend. Nora can't understand why Nick dated that girl in the first place. In this scene, Nick is giving Nora a ride to another show in his battered old Yugo. Nora is played by Kat Jennings.
Can I just ask, what did you see in her? I could floss with that girl.
This is your friend that we're talking about?
Okay, forget it. I can't do this.
Do what?
Just make a U-turn and take me back to Ludlow, all right? I'll find my own way.
Perfect.
I refuse to be the goodie bag at your pity party, Nick.
You don't have to yell. It's not a train station. I'm in a tiny car.
Just drive me off.
I will.
Are you crazy?
I don't know what I did to you to make you so angry.
Nothing. You're ridiculous.
No, you don't even know me.
I know you. I know your make.
My make?
You're an emo punk band boy and you're obsessed with Triss. They can make action figures out of you, drummer not included.
You know, it's funny that Triss never mentioned you considering what good friends you are, but she did mention some that was completely jealous.
Oh, jealous?
Yeah, and
oh,
so
really?
Now I think I know exactly who she... All right, sweetheart, you think you have something to...
I am not jealous!
Oh, no, man, she's not jealous.
Michael Cera, welcome to Fresh Air. You're part of this kind of like new movie phenomenon, which is, you know, like the leading man as the guy who's not the like muscular hunk. You know, you're a guy. You look like a regular guy, and
yeah.
You look like somebody who has an inner life. Like
yeah.
You think, like you like music, like you probably read books. You know
yeah,
what I'm saying?
I think I know what you mean. Yeah,
and I'm wondering if you saw that coming, if you mm-hmm. knew that there'd be that kind of role for you.
Well, I never.
I should
thought
add
about
ironic
it, really.
In there.
Yeah, yeah. I never really thought about it too much. I mean, I just started acting because I thought it was fun, and you know, I was 9 years old when I started, and yeah, I just always enjoyed doing it, being on sets and working with people.
You first became famous in the United States for Arrested Development.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, that was by far the biggest part I'd ever had.
How'd you get the part?
I sent an audition tape in that me and my parents made in their bedroom. You know, it was I had actually done a Fox show the year before that never aired. But I guess they knew me from that over there, the Fox casting people. And so I sent this tape in, and they were already aware of me and brought me in to audition in person and meet Mitch Hurwitz, who created the show, and the Russo brothers, who were directing the pilot. And it went well. I auditioned with Alia Shokat, who plays my cousin in the show. We read together, and we both found out that day that we got the parts in the pilot.
Let's get back to the fact that you made an audition tape in the bedroom with your
yeah,
mother?
Yeah, well, yeah, we used to do that a lot instead of having to fly out, you know, just to audition, which, you know, it's like a one in a million shot. There's so many other kids. Because I live in Toronto, you know, we would just send a tape in.
What kind of tape? Like, what would you do? What would
well,
you, do,
you know, you
do
get some
sides.
You get like the audition sides that everybody gets, and we just put a sheet up, and I would stand in front of it, and it would be like basically if I was auditioning for them in person, you know, they'd have me stand against a wall or something and read the lines. So it was really no different.
Would your mother play the other person's part?
Yeah, she would read the other lines. We've done a lot of things that way.
So what do they send you? What sides? When an actor says sides, that means
yeah, it's like
it's
one
just
scene.
Their part,
or a few scenes, you know, just so they can. You get a sense of how you're going to play the character.
Yeah. So what did they send you?
Well, it was a few scenes. They sent me the whole script to read, and I loved it. You know, I really loved the tone of the show. I knew what Mitch was going for, and
and thought it was really funny, which was really exciting to me, you know. And the scenes were like just some of the, I guess, the introductory scenes for the character, you know, in the pilot he's introduced. And so we did that scene, which I thought I kind of didn't really get a real grasp for the character until I went to L.A. because it was kind of written like an idiot, which I don't think that character is dumb in any way. And then I met Mitch, and it was kind of – there's a lot of Mitch in the character. And he told me a little more how to play it. You know, he's just genuine, and he's really trying to please his father. And so that became a little more clear. But, yeah, so I did that scene, you know, where we kind of meet him for the first time, and then maybe one other one.
Let's get to a scene. We'll play a scene from deeper into the series. You've been dating a girl that your father doesn't approve of because he thinks – among other things, that she's not attractive enough, and she's unworthy of you. So you're in the kitchen with your father, played by Jason Bateman.
How'd that math test work out?
Oh, it was okay, I guess, but I don't know, it was weird. I studied with Anne, but I still got a B-.
Anne got you a B-.
Well, it wasn't Anne. She's an expert in math. Isn't that cute?
Is it?
Michael felt his son was setting the bar too low with his dating standards.
No, it wasn't Anne's fault. You know, I think I just ended up thinking about the questions too long. And so by the time I put an answer down, I went with, like, my fifth choice or something like that.
Oh, George Michael, never settle for fifth choice. Something better is going to come along. She just has to.
I think maybe sitting in the back of the class with Anne is a bad idea. No, she's just so pretty. I get distracted, I guess.
Do you?
I wish I could draw her nose.
Maybe it's your eyes. Maybe you need glasses for your grades. You know, didn't you say you had a hard time reading the board, sitting in the background?
No, I said I was in the back of the classroom. That's
yeah.
Still,
oh, that's what I mean.
No, but
yeah.
Well, I don't know. Maybe.
No, definitely. I'll call the eye doctor.
I guess.
I'm going to set you up an appointment. Okay.
And that's Jason Bateman and my guest Michael Cera in a scene from Arrested Development. And Michael Cera is starring in the new movie Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. That's a great scene. I mean, it shows how, like, your father means well, like, he means to help you in that scene,
yeah.
But he's definitely doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, I love his character, you know, because he's always appears to have the, you know, the best intentions at heart. But sometimes it seems like he's, you know, just not quite putting his son first, you know. I don't know. I really love some of the things that he says in that series.
My guest is Michael Cera, and he's starring in the new movie Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. Let me ask you about Superbad.
Yeah.
And, you know, the premise of Superbad is that you and the character played by Jonah Hill are two guys in that transitional period between high school and college.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to go to this, like, really cool kids party, but since you're not, like, the coolest kids, in order to get in, you're going to ingratiate yourselves and bring the beer, even though you're underage.
Right.
And as part of that adventure, you end up in a party – another party in someone else's house. And the guys there are all kind of, they're older,
they're
tough, they're scary.
Very threatening.
Very threatening. And they're really toying with you.
Yeah.
And then one of them thinks you're somebody else.
Right.
And
I get locked in a room with a handful of guys doing drugs, and it's very scary.
Yes. So let's play that scene. And this is from Superbad with my guest, Michael Cera.
Hi.
Who is that guy?
I don't know.
Who's this guy?
Hey, fellas.
Who's this guy?
Everyone.
Who are you?
I'm nobody.
No. I know you. He was at that party with me, the one I was telling you about.
No.
Is it? Remember? He's Jimmy's brother, the guy, the singer. He's the guy with the beautiful voice I was telling you about.
No, Jimmy's brother.
That's not me, man.
Oh, my God.
Sing for us. Sing.
Oh, it's not me?
No.
Lying?
I don't mean to, you know, accuse you guys of being ill-informed.
My brother came all the way from Scottsdale, Arizona to be here tonight. And you're not going to sing for him?
Sing.
Singer.
You sing, and you sing good.
Sing it again.
Like a bird.
No, I know. I want to.
You want a line of cocaine?
No way, man.
Yeah.
Don't make this weird. Sing. Sing it again.
Me,
Turbo.
Me.
These eyes. Cry every night for you. These arms. They long to hold you. Hold you again. Boom, boom, boom. The hurting's on me, yeah.
Talk about the hurting.
And I will never be afraid. Oh, no.
Yeah.
You gave a promise to me, yeah. And you broke it.
Oh,
you broke it.
honey. These eyes are crying. These eyes have seen a lot of love, but they're never gonna see another one like I have with you. These eyes are crying. These eyes have seen a lot of love, but they're never gonna see another one.
That's a great scene from Superbad.
I like the fight thing.
With my guest, Michael Cera. We're missing the great little self-conscious dance moves that you do while you're
right.
While you're
singing. There was
that.
A whole take of that that was just dancing. We did three different versions of that scene, one of which was just, the guy was saying, like, you're a terrific dancer, you know, and they make me do this weird dance, which I liked that too, but I guess they liked this one the best.
Tell me about singing in a way that's like, part really pretty good and part just like so like off and self-conscious and nervous.
Well, I was just, I guess, trying to think of what it would be like in this situation where you're being forced by these guys that are high on cocaine to sing in a room, you know. It just felt like it would be really scary.
And what about These Eyes? Who chose that as the song?
I think maybe Seth and Evan. You know, it was like one of a handful of songs that they could afford. And it was between that and, like,
paying for the rights to use it in the movie.
Right. This was the only one that wasn't, like, hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know. And, just even to have me sing it is so expensive. So, I guess that had something to do with it. And also it seemed like a song that had layers that these guys could sing the other parts of, you know.
Now, your movie Juno was a huge hit, kind of a little phenomenon. So let's play a scene from Juno.
Great.
And as everybody, I think, knows, the premise of Juno is that she's a pregnant teenager who decides to keep the baby,
right,
but find a worthy couple to give the baby to to adopt. So the movie opens with you and Juno, who are at this point very good friends, having sex that's initiated because she says she's bored.
Yeah.
And she gets pregnant, and then you're kind of in love with her. And she's kind of too cynical to even realize that or to understand her own feelings.
Right.
This is a scene where you're both in the hallway of the high school by the lockers. And because you think that she doesn't really care for you, you've asked a girl to the prom.
Right.
You tell her she is really angry. Here's the scene.
You're being really immature. You have no reason to be mad at me. I mean, you know, you broke my heart. I should be royally ticked off at you. You know, I should be really cheesed off. I shouldn't want to talk to you anymore.
Well, because I got bored and had sex with you and I didn't want to, like, marry you?
Like I'd marry you. You'd be the meanest wife ever, okay? And I know that you weren't bored that day because there was a lot of stuff on TV and then the Blair Witch Project was coming on Stars. And you were like, I haven't seen this since it came out, so we should watch it. But oh, no, we should just make out instead. La, la, la.
You just take Katrina the douche packer to prom. I'm sure you two will have, like, a real bitchin' time.
Well, I still have your underwear.
I still have your virginity.
God, would you shut up?
What, are you ashamed that we did it?
No.
Because at least you don't have to have the evidence under your sweater. I'm a planet.
Wait, let me get your bag. You shouldn't be carrying it.
What's another 10 pounds?
That's Ellen Page and my guest Michael Cera in a scene from Juno. That la 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 that you do at the end of a thought in there, was that yours or was it written into the script?
No, that was definitely in the script. I specifically remember seeing it written down.
And you do all this like self-conscious stumbling in it. It's one of the things that you do so well in your performances when it's appropriate. And I guess I'm wondering about the thought process of that. Do you let it just happen in a natural way? Do you think in advance?
Where is
he going to hesitate?
I think I got that from Jason Bateman, actually, like watching him rehearse, doing things. You know, I inadvertently picked that up from him. Like, we got the scripts with Arrested Development the morning that we would start shooting that episode, you know? And so nobody, like, has their lines memorized, which I guess, you know, that would be insane if everyone did that in television. Maybe some people do it, but that's a lot of work, you know, memorizing every night. And so we would come in and rehearse the scene, and we'd all be so, you know, it would be so fresh that none of us would be familiar with it, and we'd have to keep looking at the sides. And Jason naturally kind of would do that while reading, and it's very natural, you know, and he somewhat does it in the show. But yeah, just during the rehearsals, I really, I you know, this is me kind of learning how to act, and I was like, I guess that's what people do. And I guess I picked it up from him.
So what was it he was doing that you picked up on?
Well, you know, he would stammer if he couldn't remember what he was supposed to say and then look at the page. And yeah, it just, I guess it's something I kind of picked up.
You grew up in Canada?
Yep.
Where in Canada?
In Toronto.
Describe the neighborhood that you grew up in.
Well, I grew up in Brampton, which is a suburb of Toronto, which is about an hour north of the city, or maybe 40 minutes with no traffic.
How did you know, and when did you know that you wanted to act?
Well, I was interested in acting when I was really young. I think I did these like classes, which, you know, where you play games with other kids and do kind of, you know, like improv games and stuff. And it's just for fun. It's not for any reason. And then you kind of like put on a performance for the parents, you know, at the end of the year. And one of the teachers one year told my mom, you should get an agent and you know, you can make some money doing commercials or something and put money away for college. And yeah, he just really believed in me. This guy was very supportive. And me and my mom, you know, looked up agents in Toronto, and I met with one guy who didn't want to sign me. And then the next person I met with was Amanda Rosenthal, who's my Toronto agent still. And she just believed in me and, you know, and took me on. And I started going to auditions and getting parts and just loved it and kept doing it, you know, and having a lot of fun.
So you started auditioning for commercials.
Yeah.
What's the first audition you went on?
The first, well, I went on like a some kind of print ad audition for Sunny D that I didn't get, but that's the first memory I have of like going to an audition with a bunch of other kids. But after that, I went on a commercial audition for Tim Hortons, which is a big Canadian coffee chain. And I got that part. It was the first commercial audition I'd ever been on. And that was extremely exciting. It was non-paying. It was just like, you know, it was just a day of basically playing, doing camp stuff, and they filmed it. And I saw it on TV a few times, and that was exciting. And after that, I went on, you know, hundreds of commercial auditions and didn't get any. I only ever did one more, a Pillsbury commercial where I poked the doughboy. And that was shortly after, I think. And then there was a long run of, like, not getting any commercial parts, which is extremely discouraging. Especially because, you know, I lived in Brampton and we'd have to drive downtown to Toronto, which is like an hour drive each way a few times a week. And, you know, it's like very discouraging and they want you to be very hammy, you know, and there's 100 other kids in the audition room. It felt really forced and uncomfortable and I didn't want to be big. And it just, you know, there's some people that can really do that and make a living that way. And I just wasn't capable of it.
You're kind of the opposite of big. It's like you live in parentheses half the time in your roles. You know, everything's almost like an aside.
Yeah. That's a funny way to put it.
Now, you did a series of short internet films called Clark and Michael.
Oh, yeah, they're like a little series.
Yeah, just describe the series. They're on the internet now. I don't know if you're still making them or not.
No, we're done making them, but I think they'll be on there for, you know, forever until someone takes them down. But it's on clarkandmichael.com. It's just something that my friend and I did. You know, we wrote these episodes as just like a fun thing to do. And both liked writing and we're both writing on our own and just started writing these things just to kill time and have something to show people. And then when we made it, it was just, you know, an opportunity to make it, which we'd never really planned on. So, yeah, we made it for CBS. CBS gave us some money to make it for their website. And it was great, and I'm happy with it.
What were you able to do because you were writing it that you hadn't been able to do in parts that were written for you?
Oh, I mean, anything we wanted, you know. I mean, I could be nasty in it, and it was a lot of that. You know, it was a lot of getting to do obnoxious things, which was a lot of fun.
Why don't we hear a scene? And this is a scene where you're going to an audition because you're an aspiring actor in it.
Right.
So you're going to an audition, and here you are in the audition scene.
So can you say your name and agency into the camera, please?
Yeah. My name is Michael Sarah. I'm with the Fresh Faces Agency, the FFA.
Okay, and what role are you reading today, Michael?
I'm reading for the part of James.
Okay. Are you James? Are you my James?
I think I am. I think this part was written
then
for
me. Then show it. Go. Lock eyes with me. Just for a minute. Feel it. Go.
You know, my little sister always said to me, aim for the stars and one day you'll be one of those stars. That was before the big wreck.
Eat
James.
This thing is getting out of hand, Andy. If you don't tell someone, you're going to jail for a long, long time.
Oh, is that right, James? And how exactly are the police going to find out?
Your first mistake, Danny, was saving my life.
That's a scene from Clark and Michael, featuring my guest Michael Cera. And it's an internet-only series that's online as we speak. I hate to think that you've been on auditions as awful as that.
Oh, yeah, I definitely have. I was in an audition once where it was like a werewolf movie or something, and it was just like painful reading the lines. You know, there's definitely some painful ones, and especially when you're like, I'm not getting this part. Why am I here, you know?
Because the lines are so bad, and you have to try to read them with conviction.
You know, it's just not for you, you know? I mean, like, I've auditioned for parts where I was playing, like, some tough bully or something. It's like, what am I doing here? It just feels so wrong, you know? But you're told to go anyway just to, you know, so that they're aware of you, even if it's not the right part for you.
Well, Michael Cera, it's been great to talk with you.
You too, yeah.
I wish you continued success. And
thank you.
And thank you so much.
Thank you. That was great.
Michael Cera's new film, Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, opens Friday. Everyone has their favorite Paul Newman performance. For me, I suppose it was his portrayal of a pool shark in the 1961 film The Hustler.
You sure you don't want to quit, friend?
Let's cut out the small stuff, huh? $100 freeze out. 10 games, $10 a game. Winner take all. And then we'll see who quits.
Okay, friend. You're on.
Call it.
Heads. You win. You better not miss, friend.
I don't rattle, kid. But just for that, I'm going to beat you flat. That's one.
Like his very many fans, we were sorry to hear of Paul Newman's death. In yesterday's New York Times obituary, Algene Harmetz wrote, quote, "If Marlon Brando and James Dean defined the defiant American male as a sullen rebel, Paul Newman recreated him as a likable renegade," unquote. Newman studied with Brando and Dean at the Actors Studio. When I spoke with Newman in 2003, I asked if he thought of himself, back in the Actors Studio days, as part of a generation bringing something new to acting.
Well, they did bring something new to acting, but it was also a new time of experimentation and playwriting. The social dramas of the 1930s had been pretty much exhausted through the group theater, and we were beginning on the era of Freud and what we used to call the kitchen drama, which is Mummy Never Kissed Me, which is why I'm slitting your throat today.
So, I mean, was it exciting for you to feel like you were a part of something new?
Well, I don't know at the time that you really know that you're part of something new. You just know that you're part of something that's really exciting. And I certainly did feel that. Although, I must say, I had no idea what I was doing until maybe 10 years ago.
Why do you say that? I mean, no one will agree with you on that.
Well, what is. And I take a look at all that stuff that I did previous to this and wish I had a chance to take another crack at it.
Is there something that you would really do different that you could put your finger on?
Less is more.
Uh-huh.
And I was working awful hard in most of the early stuff.
What were some of the movies that you'd seen when you were young that made a really big impression on you?
Can't remember one.
Really?
Yes, until Waterfront.
What made an impression on you about that? What did...
Just the grittiness of it and the realism and the spontaneity of it, the reality of it.
And was that something that you felt you were already doing or that you wanted to try to do?
Well, I was pretty much an oratorical actor up until then, from the old school, 1920s, early Barrymore, stuff like that. Go back and see The Silver Chalice. That was really wreckage.
That's your early biblical epic.
Pretty much, yes.
Now, your father owned a sporting goods store.
Yes.
Did you have to work in the store when you were growing up?
Oh, yes. I started working in the store, I think, when I was about 10. On the weekends, I would go down. My brother and I would both go down and work in the stock rooms. I also sold Fuller brushes.
Oh, really? Door to door?
Door to door.
Were you a good salesman?
You betcha.
Really? What made you good?
I also had a great laundry business in, when I was at Kenyon. I also peddled whiskey illicitly in Seattle when the war was over. So I've always really been a businessman, so salad dressing is no surprise.
Paul Newman recorded in 2003. He died Friday at the age of 83.